Hello everyone, my name is Frederick Eason and I write the Necker Substack, and today I'm going to do something new, which is I will record a solo episode about a story, or a person rather, Kirk Corian, who I've written up for premium subscribers and thought it would be interesting to just sort of give a short synopsis of his story, why I liked it, some highlights, his arc, and some lessons I took away from it. Now, I'm not going to be reading out the pieces. This is going to be shorter. If you're interested in digging in more, you can either look at the two pieces I wrote, or there's a good detailed biography called The Gambler, which I'd also recommend. It's a fun read. So why Kirk Kerkorian? Well, to me, it's a crazy story. I mean, Kirk grew up in California, the son of Armenian immigrants, born in 1917. And he grew up really penniless. His dad, at some point, built a huge collection of ranch and agricultural properties, but was highly levered. And so that speculation went bust when there was a recession in the 1920s. And so Kirk dropped out of high school. He started working these odd jobs. He really, all his life, I think he had this chip on his shoulder about this lack of education. And then the Great Depression hits, and there is no money to go around. And really, there isn't anything until that point in the story to suggest that Kirk Kerkorian would become one of the richest people in the country. And it's sort of amazing to me how he parlayed his way to the top, how scrappy he was, how much of a survivor and learner he was, in the sense that later he battles for the control of public companies. He develops the sort of mega resort style in Vegas. He hits, towards the end of his life, MGM is basically one of the biggest casino companies and gaming and entertainment companies in the world. He almost buys Chrysler. It's crazy that that could happen from somebody who started with really no advantages, no network, no net worth, no education, nothing really, but this really just boundless energy and enthusiasm to do another deal, and creativity and resilience. And so I think that's really inspiring, and it's a fun story too, because it has a bunch of ups and downs. And he has this great quote where he says, "Life is a big craps game. I've got to tell you, it's all been fun." And that, I think, really speaks to his enthusiasm for the deal and for taking risk. And so let's start at the beginning. Like I said, he dropped out of school, and he said he started working at 9 years old, which in his words, when I started bringing income into the family, you get a drive that's a little different, maybe a little stronger than somebody who inherited. And so his story really doesn't begin until he's working this odd job, and a friend of his introduces him to a flight school, and he works his way through to become an accomplished pilot. And in World War II, he gets the chance to fly these Mosquito airplanes for the British Air Force as a civilian pilot from Canada, where they're being manufactured across the Atlantic. Now, that's dangerous work. It's well compensated. A bunch of these planes get lost. They just vanish without a trace in the Atlantic, without, you know, lack of fuel or getting lost or ice, the ice over. And Kirk survives, and he comes out of the war with a little nest egg. So he goes back to Los Angeles, and he has this little capital base. And what does he do? Well, he knows planes. He's a good pilot. And so he starts to do two things. He buys and sells airplanes, especially surplus planes coming out of the war inventory. And he buys these, refurbishes them, he sells them. Sometimes he buys broken planes, combines them, and sort of makes money deal by deal, just like a value investor or a fix and flip housing investor, because he knows his asset really well. Sometimes they're mispositioned. He'll find them in South America or in Hawaii and like relocates them where he can find a better buyer. And he also starts flying these charter flights from LA to Vegas, where there's sort of this boomtown is emerging. And here's another quote of his. "I had $10,000 to my name, a car, no home, a wife. I was 28 years old, so I took the airplane and flew charters to Las Vegas. And from there, I got interested in the hotel business." Now, interested is a little bit of an understatement, because it seems that he became sort of a regular at the tables. He was a passionate gambler himself. And he does his first deal, which is a small investment in the Dunes Casino. He loses that, realizes that he sort of needs more control over his deals. But he's also falling in love with Vegas, and he really thinks that town has a prosperous future. And so in 1962, His charter airline has grown a little bit. He sells it to a car maker named Studebaker for $1 million. And then he flips that cash and buys a big plot of land, a little bit off the strip. And then he barters with people, with owners of smaller properties that are right on the strip. And eventually he has this prime piece of real estate, which becomes the ground for Caesar's Palace. So that's a very successful casino. He has a little profit share and he gets a lease payment, and he turns his first $1 million into nine when he sells out the property. Turns out the car maker was not good at running his airline, so he buys the airline back, keeps growing it, eventually takes it public, and now he's sort of on a roll. And he does a few things sort of in parallel and in quick succession. The first thing is he wants to build the biggest hotel in Vegas, what he calls the International, with 1,000 rooms. It's going to be expensive. It really puts him on the map. It's the first time there's a big profile in the newspaper about him. He also gets into conflict there with Howard Hughes, who moved to Vegas and bought a bunch of the casinos and didn't want Kerkorian, this newcomer, to outshine him. And he develops the property. He takes the company public before the construction is even finished. It's a big success, but it's also very levered. And he goes to Europe to find money from European banks, sort of bridge loans. And this is sort of he gets more comfortable with it, but it's also a little bit of a tenuous position. He's at this point he's really confident, and he does three deals at the same time, but he's also using leverage in an aggressive way. The second deal is that he sells his airline to Transamerican Corporation and then immediately turns around and takes a stake in another airline, Western Airlines, which is a publicly traded regional carrier that just got new routes to Hawaii. And then the third deal is that he takes a stake in MGM, which is sort of one of the big casinos, but it's failing. It has a valuable library and some real estate, but it's losing money. So it's pretty undervalued assets. And so he buys into that. And now suddenly all of his money is tied up. He has the hotel. He has two public holdings, but he's pretty illiquid. It's also this funny moment. He has this big hotel opening. All these celebrities show up, and Kirk is really shy, hates speaking in public, and sort of stays away from the opening. Now, the big turnaround comes when he needs to raise cash to pay off some of the loans, and he's trying to sell some of his stock in the International. And the problem is that his voice shows up in a recording at a mob trial, and he was sort of had dealings with somebody over what he calls a gambling debt that he was paying off. And he also bought another casino from the mob that he used to train staff for his hotel. And so at this point, the SEC just kind of blocks the sale pending further investigation. And he needs cash. And what can he do? The stock of the International sort of crashes from 65 to 650. And he's basically forced to sell control of the International, which he has to sell to the Hilton family, which is rich in cash and sort of been waiting. And it becomes the Las Vegas Hilton. That's clearly a painful loss, but he gets over it. He gets a little bit annoyed that they changed the name, but it also says, "We built the number one hotel in the world. It was an excellent enterprise. I have no regrets." So he swallows his pride. He cashed out $50 million from the whole project, and he's ready for the next big deal, which is MGM. Which was trading at $25. Him and his advisors, they saw $69 of value between primarily the library and the real estate and all the other pieces that were part of this sort of mini media conglomerate. So he buys this, he puts in a new CEO, they cut a lot of staff, sell real estate. He's called a one-man wrecking crew. They have a big yard sale of all the movie memorabilia, and the movie studio sort of goes, the bleeding stops. It never, for a long time, it doesn't become a really good studio, but at least it's not losing a lot of money. But the real angle for him is he wants to build another one of these big resorts, and he uses the MGM brand, which he calls the three golden letters, to build the MGM Grand, which is sort of a massive hotel, which opens to great success. Also, is the place for one of the biggest, deadliest fires in Vegas history, where a lot of people perish in 1980. And Kerkorian later sells that one to Bally's. And today's MGM Grand, this emerald green building is another the next iteration of the MGM Grand, which he builds in the early 90s. So now comes one of my one of the favorite deals that I think is just so interesting. He has a studio. He's not really investing enough money in it. He's kind of stingy, and the talent that he gets to run the studio, it just doesn't really work and perform. And in the 80s, he decides it's time to cash in, and the most valuable piece of the studio is the library of films. And Kerkorian knows exactly who to sell it to. Ted Turner, at that point, was sort of this upstart entrepreneur who had taken his father's billboard company, bought radio stations, and then gotten into television. And Turner knew his licenses for content were coming up for renewal, and he knew his margins were going to get squeezed. He had done this brilliant thing of buying like a local TV station in Atlanta and then somehow relinking it via satellite to like a national audience of cable subscribers. And so the cost of content for him, given this bigger audience, upon renegotiation was that cost was going to go up dramatically. So he needed a library. He really wanted the library that Kerkorian could offer him. So Kerkorian was like, okay, I'm going to put MGM on the market. I'm going to run an auction. I'm going to hire bankers. Unless you sign an ironclad agreement that you're going to buy it and you have to sign within 2 weeks. And he, you know, Turner was like, okay, fine, I'll manage it somehow. And so Turner gets himself into this really uncomfortable situation. He hires Drexel, actually Milken's Drexel is on both sides of the transaction, both advising Kerkorian and Turner, but they can't place the debt. It looks like Turner Broadcasting is just going to be too levered after this deal. And so they struggle to place the debt, and the deal changes shape a bunch of times. Kerkorian is going to buy back, first he's going to buy back the United Artists studio, so part of the studio, and then they renegotiate the cash portion, and Kerkorian's going to get preferred stock. And the preferred stock's dividend, which is 14%, is going to be paid in either cash or common stock. And when Drexel continues to fail to place the debt, Turner is sort of in this really uncomfortable situation where he has this preferred stock that's over time going to pay out common stock, voting stock, to Kerkorian. And so he calls up John Malone. He's like, John, you've got to do something, or CNN is going to become Kerkorian News Network, KNN. And so he gets bailed out by Malone and other cable operators, and the deal gets completely redone. The only thing that stays with Turner is the library, which he later uses to launch other cable channels like the Cartoon Network. And Kerkorian gets the studio assets back and the distribution assets. He then turns around, sells those to a European media entrepreneur. When that person goes bust, he buys it back from the bank. And then 2004, I think, he sells it to Sony. So this is the period where Kerkorian is really in his element. Some of these assets, he just knows them really well, and he can exploit the weakness of others, and when they run into trouble with leverage, to his advantage. He also makes a big bet on Chrysler, which was sort of emerging from a disastrous period under Lee Iacocca. He tries to take it over. That doesn't work. He tries to partner with Iacocca when Iacocca retires. That doesn't really work. He still makes $2.5 billion when Chrysler is eventually sold to Daimler. And this is sort of, I think, the peak around 2000, when Kerkorian has a studio, which he's eventually going to sell, and he has MGM, the casino company. He's built the MGM Grand, and he starts to, the second version, and he starts to buy other casino companies. He buys Steve Wynn's Mirage when Wynn has a tough time. And he later buys the Mandalay Bay, and MGM sort of expands both in Vegas and globally and becomes this massive gaming behemoth. So Kirk at that point is at the peak of his power and probably should have cashed out and put all the money in index funds. Now, that's not something you do if you're a self-made billionaire. But the reality is that his core holding, right, MGM, was going to run into the financial crisis, and he started another huge development in Vegas, and all of that lost a lot of value because Vegas got hit really hard in the housing crisis, and everything was levered, and Kerkorian kept making bets on automakers. He bought into GM and later into Ford, and sold the Ford stock at the bottom in 2008. And I think that's something you can see in a lot of people who are self-made and successful, that really strongly identify with their personality as a builder or investor or deal maker, and who just won't retire and who love playing the game, and then will overstay their welcome and can be out of touch with the market and still make big bets and lose some of their winnings again. But to me, it doesn't take away from the story at all. I think the fact that he loved doing deals, loved taking the risk and envisioning bigger projects and figuring out a new deal, a new investment, and had that enthusiasm until the very end of his life, that I think is really inspiring. I think he was brilliant despite a complete lack of education at seeing value where others just couldn't, in MGM, in airplanes, in real estate, in automakers. He just sometimes spot these opportunities. That there's a great quote that was in Vanity Fair where somebody said about him, Kerkorian makes these huge stupid deals and always comes out richer. And I think that's brilliant, right? He's this outsider, and the guys who are supposed to make the money, who are supposed to be smart at the deals, they're just scratching their heads. What the hell did he do again? And so, yeah, that's why I love the story. Sort of this very unassuming, very private person, but very scrappy, very ambitious, creative deal maker, and really resilient when things don't go his way, and just bounces back and loses the biggest hotel, just builds the next biggest hotel right after, and really perceptive and creative in where he saw value. So to me, that's a really interesting story. I hope you enjoyed it. If you want to read more, you can find that on my Substack. You can also read the biography. And until next time, bye-bye.